Also, there was a fellow called Robert Welland, who was the same term as I was, and eventually became a rear admiral and was on the defense staff in Ottawa. And at the same time, there was a fellow called Bill Landymore, who was the chief of staff to Admiral Pullen, and he subsequently became much better known as Admiral Landymore, who was also right. My term, and also became involved with the struggle with Mr. Hellyer over unification.
Did you know Landymore very well at this time?
Oh, I've known Landymore. Yes, his wife was a godmother to one of my children. We joined the Navy on the same day. We'd known each other for years. We played bridge together. We looked after each other's kids from time to time. My daughter broke her leg skiing at Wentworth outside Halifax. Mrs. Landymore was the one who was up there and took her down to the hospital and got her leg in a cast. We were good friends up till unification, and then we weren't after that.
You haven't been friends after that, or?
Well, they don't speak to us.
They don't speak to you.
No, I stayed in.
That's enough to not speak to you anymore.
Also, I was, at the time of unification, I was the chief of plans for the armed forces, working for Mr. Hellyer. And he was the minister, and I was working for him, and that was that. And,
that's good enough.
Whether or not I agreed with everything he did, I was required to either work for him or hand in my papers. I don't think they ever forgave me for not... taking a stand against unification and getting out. And so subsequently, they've never spoken to her. And my daughter, who's a goddaughter, has never heard from her godmother again. And I didn't think unification was important, quite frankly. Or at least I thought unification was important, if you like, but it wasn't, didn't have anything to do with,
you were that close
with 14 or 15-year-old goddaughters.
Thank you, sir.
Oh, yes, we were very close friends. We'd known each other for years and years.
Well, you'd mentioned last time, off the tape, that just before unification, you and Landymore had quite a discussion in a hotel room somewhere.
In Paris. Yeah, we were over in Paris together. I don't know what he was doing there. I think he was working in London at the time, or he was in Paris for some reason. And I was over there with the minister at a NATO conference.
This would be Hellyer.
Yeah, and... He started to talk about it, and I kept saying that I agreed with him, and he should do what he thought he should do, and so on. But I didn't think that he should quit. If he felt that strongly that that the armed forces were in peril, or that this whole policy was leading the wrong way, and so on, that he could fight it. Up to the point where he said, well, now I've said my piece, Mr. Minister, and now I'll shut up, or else he could resign. But if he was going to do anything about modifying the impacts of things that he thought were wrong and so on, he certainly couldn't do it from his farm outside Halifax. He'd have to stay on the bridge if he wanted to alter course. But he didn't see it that way, because I think he was far more emotionally involved or professionally involved, or thought he saw more catastrophe or danger or imminent collapse of the whole of the defense structure in it than subsequently transpired. However, it was enough that he did resign, and of course, after all the acrimony and the heat and so on of the hearings in Ottawa before the defense committees. So then he resigned, and that was the end of Landymore. There was nothing more he could do, and this, of course, was the great shame, because he was a tremendously talented and capable man, and the Canadian Armed Forces and the Canadian government structure in Canada needed people of his talent and so on to make the best of it, to make it go as best could be. And I kept saying to him, I don't think it's fair that you should go to the point where you have to resign, because as soon as you do, then you can do us no more good. However, However, he didn't see it that way, and so he subsequently resigned, and as is always the case with one-day heroes, if that was Friday, on Tuesday he couldn't sell his story to the Macleans because they'd had it.
This is sort of leaping ahead from 1950.
Yeah, well, we were just talking.
Well, this was relating to people who were in Halifax until then.
At that time.
He was in Halifax as chief of staff when I went to the squadron.
Yeah, the squadron.
And that's how we leapt ahead. But of course, by judicious cutting, these can be placed in context. and indeed dubbed to say something quite different anyway.
Is that possibility?
Tell me, there's one thing that interested me, you know, talking about subs and sub chases. Again, when you were there in 59, were they still working hard on the hydrofoil ship?
Oh, yes, it was going ahead. It was, I guess at that stage, if I recall accurately, they were doing a tremendous amount of testing on metals for foils. This was the big problem, for metals that would be fine enough for the foils and still wouldn't be subject to stress and cracking and so on for the main foils of the thing. And the boat was, they were doing experiments in tanks and things like that, and it was just sort of coming to fruition. I never saw the thing. In fact, I've never seen it yet.
Is that right?
No, I haven't been to Halifax since it's been propped up on the dock. All I've done is seen pictures of it, and I've talked to a lot of people about it, and I talked to young Tino Kateras, who was the first captain of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I've thought with horror of driving one around at night on the West Coast through the log booms at 50 or 60 knots. But I never know whether in my mind to put it in the same category as the Arrow and the and the Bobcat and all the other things that we got up to the threshold and never got over the threshold.
Yeah.
I think what we did was we developed a lot of interesting technology, and I think a system that probably could have been progressed. But I don't see any great move in other navies in the world to say the hydrofoil is the be-all and end-all of all our high-speed anti-submarine problems, anything of that sort.
Yeah. I've heard that the greatest anti-submarine weapon is another submarine.
Well, I suppose it is, really. It's
takes one to kill one, certainly.
Yes. I'm sure it is, basically, because, of course, you've got an ideal anti-submarine detection platform that can be totally silent and totally divorced from any surface noise or activity. And indeed, you presumably have a weapon system, giving them all the same capabilities, that has the speed to detect and chase another one, whether they both achieve anything by going around the ocean at, say, 35 knots, one after the other, never getting any closer, I don't know. You do reach the stage where you have to have a reach-out weapon system,
mm-hmm.
no matter what your detection organization or
mm-hmm.
capability is.
Mm-hmm.
But I would guess it would be excellent.
Well, just while we're having coffee, and I don't know how long you've been going on, but again, going back to this, or keeping on this period when you are in Halifax, first of all, how long are you there about?
Oh, I was there for about 21 months, that's all.
Is that all?
Yeah. Jobs at sea were hard to hang on to because there were always so many people who wanted them, and always so many people who were deserving of them, too.
Mm.
And indeed, as they were stepping stones to promotion, as far as executive branch people were concerned, then you had to give people the opportunity, even though you were pulling people out of ships undoubtedly sooner than they would wish to go, and maybe that sooner than was really good for the system from the continuity point of view. But in order to get the potential streamers through the organization, you had to give them their try.
And the cycle thing started at this point? The cycling of...
Yeah, the cyclic refit and employment and work up and training and work down and thing had started at this time.
Did that affect the term at all? Or?
No, it didn't really, because I think at that time it would affect quite often the captain of an individual ship, but squadron commanders were starting to rotate between ships and not have one particular ship as their responsibility so that they could go and look at the operation of each unit. So consequently, they weren't tied to a period of rundown in a ship and start up of a new cycle. because they would just move to another ship when one of them went in for refit or one of them went in for modification. And the cyclic system was fine. I don't know whether they're still doing it exactly the same way and over the same time period, but at least it did bring some order into what had been sort of a catch-as-catch-can approach to they were saying, well, things are quiet in the dockyard, let's take Crescent in for refit now. And it might not really be due for another 6 weeks, or until, by the time they had space for her as a result of haphazard operation, maybe she'd be 6 months longer than she should have to have a brake job and front wheel alignment. So, it was a more logical ship management. Ship
you would be involved in NATO exercises during this time?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Not particularly large-scale ones, as it transpired, but basically the ones that we got, the thing that we got more involved with was the use of the USN facilities at Puerto Rico for springboard and those major spring exercises, where we worked with their units in anti-submarine exercises.
Yeah.
And indeed, we're able to exploit all the resources that were brought into a major fleet exercise thing, like target towing capabilities, additional submarines for targets for anti-submarine exercises, more cooperation with more aircraft in anti-submarine than we could always bring to bear or get with our aircraft being used for other purposes, like sovereignty surveillance and things like that.
Yeah.
So that was the biggest thing that we did. The difference in the ships that I told you about in the squadrons and so on would really indicate that when Canada was going to be represented in a NATO exercise, that the Saint-Laurents or the Restigouches would be the ones to go.
Mm-hmm.
Quite naturally.
Yeah.
Because they were the ships of the way things were going. Also because they would look better from the Canadian point of view. And also because they would perform better and provide a better realistic exercise in a modern environment than the ships that I had.
Yeah. Anything vital that you remember during that two-year period, again, whether humorous, social, or otherwise?
Oh, not particularly. I remember how much fun it all was. But, you know, this is a sailor sort of saying I was at sea most of the time, and so therefore it was fun. This is quite natural. I had one good opportunity for a rather broader expanse of command for a period of about 4 or 5 weeks when I was put in charge of all the Canadian fleet exercises that were operating out of Bermuda, established a headquarters ashore, and ran the 25 or 30 ships that were involved instead of my own group of six. So this just gave me more of a scope in scheduling exercises and arranging support facilities and liaison with the Bermuda authorities about use of practice areas and things of that sort.
Mm-hmm.
But this was just a bit of luck that came my way. The fellow who was supposed to do it, James Plomer, was called away to do something else, and so I was left with the job, and so I just took my own squadron staff, called them a fleet staff, and ran the exercises for. And this was very pleasant.
What about the differences between the, shall we say, the British and American approach towards anti-submarine warfare, or was this pretty well?
Isn't really that much different.
Not that much difference.
Not that much difference. I think the Americans were quicker off the mark for going for larger powered, longer range detection systems in ships. They started, first of all, building sonar sets of 8 to 10 times the power, using the hammer approach of really whamming out a very strong signal to a very long range from a very large and sophisticated array built into the bottom of ships. We subsequently did that, but even that, those sort of things are limited, and then you changed your maximum range from 4,000 yards to 10,000 yards. Well, if you put a 10,000-yard circle in the middle of an ocean, it's still not a hell of a big, hell of a big circle. There are better ways of detection, and they're probably a mixture of use of intelligence, other surveillance systems that are more passive in nature, against which you then start to apply active systems for definition of datum and then for attack.
Mm-hmm.
Then there's a limit to how much of a dome and housing and so on you can hang under a ship and still have it effective.
Yeah.
or still have it able be able to get in and out of a Esquimalt harbor or Chesapeake Bay or something without, you know, dragging $10,000 worth of equipment off the bottom every $1 million worth of equipment off the bottom every time it tries to do anything, and also making it almost unworkable and unhandleable as a ship pretty soon.
Yeah.
It's the wrong way to do it, and what you do is you start looking for passive systems that depend on the noise of this fast and high-speed nuclear submarine, first of all giving an indication of where it is, and then using other localizing systems.
Yeah, well,
probably airborne, and then eventually getting down to a ship system and a weapon system, and bang.
Were you? Did you have at that time in 59-60 the what should we call it? Seabed based sonar system. Was that being installed?
Yes, that was installed, and that was in use. And of course, there'd been there was no information about it then at all, except that one would get the results of one would have a datum, i.e., a position of a potential submarine handed to you. Without any real knowledge of how it was developed. There's been much more even in the press and so on about the use of those
and on
those hydrophone
systems.
Have
you seen that film, incidentally?
I don't think so.
Well, I'll be showing it to my class within the next month or so, I would think. Would you like to pop up and take a boo?
Yeah.
We're getting it from the Navy.
Mm-hmm.
And I haven't seen it myself, and I'm certainly looking forward to it.
Yeah. So those were being developed, you know, and it's funny that I should see Shelburne written on your statement here, because the main Canadian station was at Shelburne, Nova Scotia, and they were essentially a sensing, listening hydrophone type of system, as was described in quite some detail and quite some accuracy in Time Magazine.
Anything coming in from satellites at that time?
No. I'm not sure that there is anything yet. Now, I'm not enough of a technical expert to determine how much a satellite can see below the surface of the water.
Yeah, there's very little written on it, but evidently things are getting more and more interesting in that field.
I know that the satellite is capable of determining with a fantastic degree of accuracy the things it can see. Down to length of conning tower. Things of that sort, but this is really just a state of the photographic and photogrammetric art, isn't it? Really, it's not. But its ability to do a medium change penetration, I don't know, and I would be very surprised. Light has trouble doing much penetration of the ocean, and I would say it would be a whole new state of the art that I know nothing about.
Yeah.
If they have developed.
Yeah. Well, I gather it's en route, shall we say, from what one picks up here and there and the other place.
If it does, then of course, and it is successful, then that's the end of the submarine as a threat.
Yeah.
Mind you, it's also the end of the surface ship, which is going to carry the weapon system as a threat if you want to attack one or t'other.
Yeah.
But the submarine's invulnerability is exposed.
Yeah.
Whereas there's no invulnerability in surface ships and so on from detection and from attack and so on.
Yeah.
At all. But the submarine has had this Linus blanket.
I think this is why they were so concerned about a year ago when the Russians had developed a capability of knocking out the spies in the skies, the saying goes, which without a doubt we have as well. And on both of these, you know, If you get canceled, you're back to the days of the sailing ship, and I can see it.
But that's always what the game is, isn't it?
Yeah, yep, I agree.
That's always what the game is.
Yeah.
See, you get a high-speed nuclear submarine until someone discovers that it makes enough noise that you can hear it on every sonar array system in the whole world as soon as it goes on to above 30 knots.
And know which one it is.
Yeah. And you look at it, and it says, my one that's got that sort of a cardiogram.
Yeah.
And you say, and we know the captain of that is actually so-and-so, and, you know, he's the one who always turns to the left under attack. You remember the guy? It's just like Chris Vokes. Always just say, attack over there. I don't like it where there are trees. So, you know, that's the game.
Yeah.
That's the game.
Yeah. Fascinating.
We're pretty much out of time, sir, because Admiral Murdoch has to leave.
I have to leave to do carting a family around.
Oh, well, we'll end it at this point then.